Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. When most people think of earthquakes, they think of something like this.
What's wrong?
The pulse rates are spiking again. They're huge.
Are you serious? Jim?
I'm about to have a major quake.
That's a scene from the 2015 movie San Andreas as the Hoover Dam proceeds to crumble. But our next guest says earthquakes don't need to be so dramatic to be serious. She also says don't think of earthquakes as threats to just the West Coast, because we here on the East Coast are also at risk. Catherine Miles is our guest. Her latest book is Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Her book comes out next week. She joins us from the studio in Portland, Maine. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So in the prologue to your book, you write, no matter where you're reading this, there's a good chance that you could throw a rock and hit a fault. Can you explain?
Sure. You know, I think historically, as you mentioned in the introduction, we've really thought of this as a West Coast problem. But as technology improves and we're able to do a better job of mapping the planet, we're finding that, in fact, faults are everywhere. And as I say in the book, unless you live in Florida, there's a decent chance you live in an area that could become seismically active in your lifetime. And that most certainly includes New England.
So how much of a risk, then, would you say? Of course, that's what we're all worried about here. How much of a risk do we face here in New England?
Well, and that's the difficult question to answer. You know, when I posed this to seismologists, they all said the same thing over and over and over again, and that is we just don't know. There's so much about this that we don't know, and it's constantly changing. There are towns like, for instance, Plainfield, Connecticut, that had had no earthquakes and then had clusters of 200-300 in the course of a single year. There's
phenomenon like 2005, right?
Correct, correct. And we think that that might have been the result of water table changes during a particularly cold winter.
So I guess then you say that we don't really know why. And I kind of want to know why we don't know why. Is it because it can be so many factors like water table changes and so many other things? Or why would it be that a major national disaster really is so mysterious still?
The analogy that I make in the book is it's kind of like looking at an X-ray and assuming you know how the human body works. You can kind of see what's in there, but you can't see a lot of nuance. And that's what's happening here. It's also a matter of resources. While we've funded the USGS to do some fairly extensive mapping in, say, California and the Pacific Northwest, as a country, we haven't made that mapping a priority in places like the Northeast. And that's too bad, because we've seen full well that earthquakes are very possible here.
And you say we've mapped, what, some 2,000 fault lines, and we're still discovering new ones?
We have approximately 2,100 known faults in the country. Mm-hmm. All of the historic earthquakes of note have occurred on faults we didn't know about, including the 1989 World Series earthquake. And we're discovering new faults all the time, including in places like under the Indian Point nuclear power plant in New York City.
And so then there's not – we don't really necessarily know much about then the connection between the faults and the quakes.
Well, we know that a fault can create a quake. What we don't know necessarily is which faults are active and which have become dormant. And we're also finding that earthquakes are, in fact, possible in places where there aren't large faults, where things like induced activities, whether it's fracking, wastewater injection, withdrawing water, oil from the earth, all of these things can create earthquakes as well.
Hmm. And what do we when we talk about sort of man-made issues related to earthquakes, is there a clear consensus about, say, fracking and earthquakes and issues like that?
In the scientific community, there is a consensus that wastewater injection does seem to create earthquakes in places like Oklahoma. That is definitely not the consensus held by some of our elected officials. There is maybe more debate about the effect of things like fracking. We have also seen that surprising phenomenon like reservoir levels, even the construction of a high-rise in Taipei appears to be causing earthquakes as well.
Mm. Now, Boston Globe magazine this weekend is coming out with a story about you talking about nuclear power plants possibly affected by quakes, particularly Pilgrim nuclear power plants, listed as having what, the second highest seismic risk of any nuclear power plant in the country. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. A few years ago, the USGS went out and sort of reassessed risk at existing power plants. And you're right that Pilgrim is number two, second only to Indian Point, which I mentioned earlier. And what's deeply concerning about this is that Pilgrim, as your listeners probably know, is set to close in 2019. And so they received a pass from the NRC regarding some pretty key seismic mitigation and retrofitting work, which has people like the Union for Concerned Scientists very, very concerned about the safety of the plant.
And Pilgrim got the pass to not have to implement the safety issues because it was going to close anyway, so they said, don't bother.
That's one read on the take, that there wouldn't have been enough time to complete it. Other people argue that the plant has been built with enough redundancies that it would be able to withstand that. But that is not the position of key nuclear insiders, as I outline in the story.
Hmm. For that Globe magazine piece, it's very interesting because you actually drove into the Pilgrim plant with an activist and no one stopped you. And you even called the police to tell them that you were there and no one stopped you. Tell us that story.
That was a hair-raising participatory journalism that I didn't expect. We spent about 45 minutes in the plant. We were not within the furthest most gate that encloses the reactor. We were well past other gates and fences, well past the signs stating use of deadly force authorized, past a guard shack that was supposed to be staffed and was not. And I think that raises some security questions as well in terms of what's happening at this plant and who is keeping us safe.
So you drove up to, what would you say, the front? You drove through several fences, past a guard gate that was supposed to be staffed, up into what, the front of Pilgrim?
Right, into a parking lot that is supposed to be restricted. Activists and even tourists have been arrested for not getting as far as we got. Again, we were not within the most critical boundary. We were not within the boundary that contains the reactor. We were within the boundary that is restricted to public access.
And then when the activists called the police and said, look, I made it this close in and I went right through past the guard check and everything else. Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, the police in Plymouth are obviously doing the best job that they can. This is private property. And so really, they can only take action when they're asked to by Entergy, the company that owns Pilgrim. And in this case, unfortunately, no one at Entergy noticed that we were there.
Mm-hmm. But didn't the police also say that it was staffed at the time and she must have been mistaken? But when she said that she was with a journalist, then they did confirm that the guard shack was not staffed at the time?
That was actually a conversation I had with the police. They told me that she couldn't have made it that far because the guard shack should have been staffed. And that was when I pointed out that I had been with her and taken a video of the entire incident.
At the beginning of our conversation, when you said you could probably hit a fault if you threw a rock, no matter where you were reading about these earthquakes, but you also said except Florida. Why is Florida the exception?
We think largely because Florida is built of sea sediment. It's kind of like a lot of the bay around Boston. And so there may be something much, much deeper. But, you know, Florida obviously has other problems like ocean levels and erosion and things like that.
Mm-hmm. In terms of other areas on the East Coast, particularly densely populated areas, you also talk about the fault that runs along the top of Central Park. And you say the city's overdue for an earthquake, right? How can an area be overdue, right?
Well, that's based on sort of historical precedent, really. Mm-hmm. Historically, New York has had a moderate quake about every 100 years. The last one was in the late 1890s, so overdue in that regard. The city of New York is actually just crisscrossed with these faults capable of moderate earthquakes. And then, as I mentioned, we've newly discovered one capable of a much larger earthquake just north of the city. Boston has had earthquakes measuring about 6.5. Experts think that one as large as 7.2 is possible. And to put that in perspective, you know, the San Francisco quake, the great San Francisco quake, was about a 7.6, 7.8, depending on who you ask.
And, of course, it would be very devastating, not just in terms of what might happen to people, but also the costs, which you've got some estimates about.
And this is really where, as a country, we need to stand up and take notice. We're never going to be able to predict an earthquake. We're never going to be able to accurately talk about what is the risk and what is the return period. But what we can do is think about infrastructure mitigation. And that's something, as a country, we need to do for all sorts of reasons. We saw that with Superstorm Sandy. We've seen this with other natural disasters. So taking the initiative as a community and as a country to put that kind of retrofitting mitigation in place so that if and when a quake does happen, we'll be safe.
And what about individuals? What do you think individuals might be able to do to somewhat prepare?
So I outline this in detail in the book, and I think the short version is we need to be ready to take care of ourselves, and we need to be prepared for the fact that what we normally do that will not be available to us. So it's entirely likely that we would not have electricity, we would not have water, we would not have gas or oil, and we wouldn't have our cell phones. So communication is going to be very difficult, getting just basic supplies. And so that's why I think it's really important for families and communities to think through emergency plans, how we're going to find one another, making sure that we do have enough water, food, warm clothes, medical supplies, that if necessary, we can take care of ourselves for a week.
All right. Catherine Miles' new book is Quakeland: On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. It's out in stores next week. Thanks, Catherine, for being with us.
My pleasure.